There's a handout that I passed around, but I think I didn't make enough copies. So if you go to the Skedge website, you can also find a link there and read along with your phone. And I've made a couple little posters in haste to try to make it visible to everyone. But it should be fine even if you don't have one. So socialism is a nebulous term and always has been. I expect that you're going to hear more than once at this conference that, according to recent polls, growing numbers of people in the United States are favorable to it. The latest Harris poll has found that 40% of Americans would prefer to live in a socialist country than in a capitalist country. Among women, the preference for socialism is 55%. Among young people, that is, among people between the ages of 18 and 24, like Everett, the preference for socialism is 66%. We don't know exactly what the people being polled think that socialism is. And the truth is, they probably think very different things about it. What we do know, though, is that there's a growing interest in what socialism is. In the latest presidential election, 12 million people voted for Bernie Sanders, a self-described democratic socialist. That year, socialism was the most looked-up word on Merriam-Webster's online dictionary. Since then, a socialist organization, the Democratic Socialists of America, have grown to more than 60,000 members, becoming the largest left group in the U.S. since the Communist Party of the 1940s. One of their members, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, won the primary. And that night on MSNBC, there was a segment titled, "What Are Democratic Socialists?" Socialism, or the specter of something called socialism, was the focus of this year's Conservative Political Action Conference, or CPAC, where U.S. President Donald Trump appeared to indicate that socialism would be the polemical target of his re-election campaign. And the next day, the Washington Post ran an article under the headline, "What is Socialism?" So we know that the question is on many people's minds. The title of this meeting, Socialism 101, Socialism from Below, was not chosen by me. It was given to me by the conference organizers because they wanted to have a general conversation, general discussion about the topic, what socialism is. This kind of discussion could go various ways. There are lots of ways one could give this talk. You could talk about the history of the modern socialist movement. You could talk about current affairs and the prospects for a socialist movement today. What I'm going to do is take as my starting point certain ideas from the Communist Manifesto, a document written in 1847 by Karl Marx and his lifetime collaborator, Friedrich Engels. I do so for two main reasons. First, because the Communist Manifesto belongs to the common inheritance of everyone who calls him or herself a socialist or a communist, of no matter what sect or tradition or tendency, of no matter what country in the world, and has been so for the last 150 years. And second, because in the Manifesto, Marx and Engels were trying to answer a question that every new generation of socialists, ourselves included, needs to answer for itself. Namely, what does socialism have to be in order to be to meet the problems that we now face? The problems that we now face could hardly be more urgent. There are concentration camps on the border. Refugees fleeing war and hunger are drowning in the Mediterranean and in the Rio Grande. Fascist movements are on the rise internationally. Basic reproductive rights are under attack. Tensions between the U.S. and its imperialist rivals, especially China, are intensifying. And humanity is now entering an ecological catastrophe which threatens our survival and which promises, in the meantime, to intensify all of those problems. So the question, what socialism means is important, but the question what it meant in the past or what it meant for Marx and Engels is, I think, a purely academic question, unless it's in the context of asking what we need it to mean going forward to address those problems that I just mentioned. Does socialism need to be feminist in order to meet those problems? Does it need to be anti-racist? Does it need to explicitly and directly confront these different forms of oppression? Does it need to be anti-imperialist to address those problems? These are critical questions for the future direction of the socialist movement. And while I think those questions have to frame our discussion and our reflection on this, I think it's also necessary to say that we cannot address those critical questions about the future direction of the socialist movement without also asking, what is our ultimate goal? And how could we possibly get there? Are we aiming for a kinder, gentler, somewhat greener version of the kind of society we live in now? Or do we need a fundamentally different way of organizing human life on Earth? There's deep disagreement about this question among people who call themselves socialists. But even among people who agree about the goal, there are important disagreements about how it should be pursued. And it's these big picture questions about what our ultimate goal is and how we could achieve it that Marx and Engels are grappling with in the Communist Manifesto, and that I want to talk about today. So, socialism is nebulous as a term now, and it's always been so. It appeared in print for the first time in England in 1827. 20 years later, Marx and Engels wrote the Communist Manifesto, and at this time, the term socialism was vaguely associated with what was then called the social question. This was the question what to do about the dangers posed by growing masses of poor people at the beginning of the Industrial Revolution. Any effort to ameliorate these social problems was considered socialist at the time. So if a church took up a collection for the poor, that was socialism. And if a wealthy philanthropist founded an orphanage or a hospital or an asylum, that was called socialism. 40 years after the Communist Manifesto was written in 1888, Engels wrote a preface to the English edition of the Manifesto in which he explained why he and Marx had decided not to call their document a socialist manifesto. Now, as an aside, Bhaskar Sankara, the editor of Jacobin, has just published a book called The Socialist Manifesto, which we'll be discussing here tomorrow at 11:30, that is, at this conference, not in this room. But I wanted to read to you the preface that Engels wrote in 1888. He said, "When it was written, we could not have called it a socialist manifesto. By socialists in 1847 were understood, on the one hand, the adherents of various utopian systems. On the other hand, the most multifarious social quacks who, by all manner of tinkering, profess to redress, without any danger to capital and profit, all sorts of social grievances. In both cases, men outside the working class movement and looking rather to the educated classes for support. But whatever portion of the working class had become convinced of the insufficiency of mere political revolutions and had proclaimed the necessity of total social change called itself communist. It was a crude, rough-hewn, purely instinctive sort of communism. Still, it touched upon the cardinal point. Thus, in 1847, socialism was a middle-class movement, communism a working-class movement. Socialism was, on the continent at least, respectable, whereas communism was the very opposite. And as our notion from the very beginning was that, quote, the emancipation of the working class must be the act of the working class itself, there could be no doubt as to which of the two names we must take." So, when the Communist Manifesto was written, the word socialism was associated in the minds of most people with two groups of people who were concerned with social problems, but who had in common a certain sort of paternalistic disdain for ordinary people. They lacked any connection to the working class movement, and they looked to the middle and upper classes for financial and political support. Alongside these socialists, though, were people who called themselves communists, and what Engels says is that these people were distinguished by their conviction that a mere political revolution was not enough. Now, we are nowadays familiar with the term political revolution, thanks to the campaign of Bernie Sanders. What I want to stress is that Bernie didn't just make this up, this term. It's got a long history in this working class movement. A political revolution is an upheaval connected with a mass movement or even with a revolt, which changes the political order, but which leaves the prevailing property relations in place, and therefore leaves the current ruling class in place. The contrast is with a social revolution. A social revolution is a political transformation that changes not merely the laws or the form of government, but the class structure of society. According to Engels, one of the two main reasons that he and Marx called their document the Communist Manifesto, rather than the Socialist Manifesto, is that they wanted to ally themselves with those who were convinced that a political revolution was not enough. And the other was that, as they thought, the emancipation of the working class must be the act of the working class itself, and the people who were involved in the working class movement were calling themselves communists. Now, in the decades after the manifesto was written, so between the time it was written and the time when Engels wrote this new note, the term socialism came to be associated with the working class movement, thanks in large part to the progress of that movement. And it came to be identified with opposition to capitalism. So that by the end of their careers, Marx and Engels were both happy to be called socialists or communists interchangeably. One of the texts that Engels wrote towards the end of his life, which I'll quote from later, is called Socialism, Utopian and Scientific, and it identifies their view as scientific socialism. Okay, so though it's useful to see what Marx and Engels thought about their contemporaries and about their predecessors, it's also true that 170 years have passed since then. A lot of things have sprung up and called themselves socialist that Marx and Engels never could have dreamed of. And we have to figure out not just where we stand in that, but also where they stand in that tradition. And there are lots of possible ways you could organize so much material. One way it's commonly done is to distinguish between revolutionary socialism and reformist socialism. Another is between violent and nonviolent socialism, or between democratic and authoritarian socialism. In a 1966 pamphlet called Two Souls of Socialism, the American socialist Hal Draper argued that while these are useful distinctions, the really fundamental distinction is between socialism from above and socialism from below. Excuse me. And since that is the subtitle of our meeting, Socialism from Above, excuse me, from below. I thought I'd say something about that. Draper writes in that pamphlet, The Two Souls of Socialism, that what unites the many different forms of socialism from above is the conception that socialism, or a reasonable facsimile thereof, must be handed down to the masses in one form or another by a ruling elite which is not subject to their control. In fact, the heart of socialism from below is its view that socialism can be realized only through the self-emancipation of activized masses in motion, reaching out for freedom with their own hands, mobilized from below in a struggle to take charge of their own destiny as actors and not merely subjects on the stage of history. Draper identifies the Communist Manifesto as the classic expression of socialism from below, and in particular, he points to the idea quoted by Engels in the passage I just read, that the emancipation of the working class must be the act of the working class itself. Now, for a brief word from our sponsors. Haymarket Books, one of our sponsors, has just republished Socialism from Below by Hal Draper, a collection that includes not just that pamphlet, but a number of other essays about it. I'm not going to say too much more about it in this talk, but I do want to point out something that's very useful about that taxonomy. The taxonomy is helpful in distinguishing what Marx and Engels were advocating in the Communist Manifesto from what are, I think, the two most familiar models of socialism. The two things that are most likely to be associated with that in the with that term in the popular imagination, and that are likely to be on the minds of the people who are being subjected to these constant polls about whether they prefer socialism or communism. The first model is Stalin's Russia, the USSR. On this model of socialism, the state controls the means of production, but the workers don't control the state. And as a result, ordinary people do not control the conditions of their lives. They are unfree, they are alienated, they are exploited. Don't want that. The other familiar model of socialism is that of social democracy, in particular 20th century European forms of, with heavy state intervention, and that are still today discussed amongst the socialist left as a model to aspire to. Now, there are both of these, on Draper's view, fall on the side of socialism from above. They might seem like radically different. Sweden and the USSR might seem like radically different kinds of society, and in many ways they are, of course. But what's interesting about and helpful about organizing the socialist tradition in terms of Draper's categorization is that both of these end up being on one side of the line with Marx and Engels' Communist Manifesto on the other, because what both of them have in common is the idea that progress for ordinary people is going to be given to them by someone else, rather than them having, through their own self-organization and activity, to go out and get it for themselves. Now, there are other substitutes for working class activity that we're familiar with and that have been associated with the term socialism. For example, peasant armies. The thought that peasant armies or guerrilla fighters or utopian communes or visionary conspiratorial coup plotters or small groups of intellectuals could save us, quite familiar. What Marx and Engels are setting themselves against is all of that. Nothing, in their view, can free us but ourselves. No one will save us. We've got to get our act together ourselves and do it from below. That, anyway, is the aspect of Marx and Engels' vision of socialism that comes to the fore when we divide the history of socialism into these terms, from below and from above. Okay, well, with that, let's turn to the Communist Manifesto itself. The first line of the first main section is that the history of all hitherto existing society is the history of class struggles. In a footnote added in 1888, Engels clarifies that this statement only applies to written history. He says that back in 1847, 40 years earlier, when they wrote the manifesto, very little was known about the prehistory of humanity. But a lot was in fact discovered in the course of their lives, and they took a great interest in it. And in fact, one of the last works that Engels wrote is all about that, all about the transition from prehistoric times to historic times, that is, before writing and with writing. And they came to understand that for most of the time that modern humans have been on Earth, society was not riven by class divisions, as a matter of fact. So the qualification that applies to that first line in section one also applies to the second quotation on the handout, where Marx and Engels say, later in the manifesto, the history of all past societies has consisted in the development of class antagonisms, antagonisms that assume different forms at different epochs, but whatever form they may have taken, one fact is common to all past ages, namely, the exploitation of one part of society by another. I want to talk about what exploitation is in a minute, but first I just want to refer now to my drawing here on the board, just to give a very cartoonish conception of some transitions between different modes of production, as they're called. These transitions are what Marx is talking about when he talks about a social as opposed to a merely political revolution, total transformation of society. So, crudely, cartoonishly, here's the picture. For most of human beings' time on Earth, we lived, and until very recently, in this spot on Earth, on that lake, on this ground, until very recently, there was no exploitation. I'll tell you what that means in a minute. There was no state. There was no government, there were no laws, there were no rich people, there were no poor people. That's most of human beings' time on Earth. Recently, the day before yesterday, basically, all that changed. And there emerged what we recognize as a family. There emerged what we now know as private property. There emerged a state. That transition here is into a new age for humanity, a new epoch, the epoch of exploitation, the epoch of the state, the epoch of patriarchy, the epoch of property. And there have been different forms of all of these things, the family, private property, and the state. The three modes of production that Marx and Engels talk about most in the Communist Manifesto are ancient slavery, feudalism, and present mode of production, capitalism. Those are different ways of organizing a society based on exploitation, which we'll get to in a minute. But there's a possibility and a hope expressed in the Communist Manifesto that we will leave this epoch of human history into another way of organizing human life, which is not exploitative. And which isn't based on class antagonisms. Fine, so what is exploitation then? That's what is characteristic of this epoch, the epoch of that encompasses all of written history thus far? Well, again, I'm going to appeal to some kind of cartoonish figures for the sake of clarity. We can just start from a simple materialist principle, an obvious truth that even a child knows. Any human society has to do labor, has to perform labor in order to reproduce itself from day to day and from generation to generation. Wherever there's a human society, wherever there's a community of living human beings, there must be goods. Food, clothing, shelter, things like that. Things like that don't fall from heaven. They're made by human beings. So wherever there's a community of living human beings, there must be not just goods, but the productive activity to produce those goods. That's pretty indisputable. Exploitation is the extraction or the forcing of extra labor, surplus labor, from one segment of society, the producers, by another segment of society. Now, this kind of thing is not always possible. So to make clear why, just imagine a toy society of 10 people, and their generational replacements, the people who are going to, you know, a kid who's going to replace them in the next generation. In order to stay alive, oh my gosh, from day to day and from generation to generation, in order to stay alive from day to day, each adult has to consume a pile of goods, a bushel of useful things. Suppose that given where they live and what they've got going for themselves and what's available in their environment and what tools they have and what they know how to do and all that, it takes 10 hours to produce that pile of goods that somebody needs to live till tomorrow. Well, how much total work needs to be done every day in that community? 100 hours. 10 hours for each of the piles that needs to be consumed. Now, there's no one to do this 100 hours of work but the people, those 10 adults, let's assume. And the work has to be distributed among them. So there's a question, how's it going to be distributed? Well, in this case, there's a way it must be distributed. Assuming that a person can only work, say, 10 hours a day, let's assume that, given that what, then each person is going to have to work all day, 10 hours. But now, fast forward, suppose that they figure out how to do some things a little better, a little faster, or they move someplace else where it's a little easier to do what they already do, and now it only takes 9 hours to produce the bundle of goods that keeps everybody alive for a day. There are some new possibilities. One thing that could happen is, from then on, everybody only works 9 hours a day. Here's another possibility. 9 of them keep working 10 hours a day, and one of them surfs the internet, or writes poetry, or studies the stars, or says prayers. That's a possibility. Suppose their productivity increases again. Now it only takes 8 hours. A second person can be released from labor, or everybody can work only 8 hours. What's important to see here is that the time it takes to produce the things that are consumed is an independent variable of how much time people spend working. The time it takes to produce what a person consumes could shrink to 1 minute or less. And still, it remained the case that 9 out of 10 people work all day long. Nothing in this that prevents that. Well, however that's distributed, when we have a case like that where some fraction of society is released from labor and is supported by the working part of society, we have exploitation. We also have classes. We also have two groups of people with fundamentally different interests. Those two classes. And thus we have class antagonism. Now you might be wondering, why the hell would the 8 people who are doing all the work put up with this? So that the 2 people can write poetry and study philosophy. Good question. The answer is, well, it's a two-part answer. The first part is the state. In the third quotation, Engels explains what he and Marx think the state, government, laws are for. Society thus far, based on class antagonisms, has had need of the state. That is, of an organization of the particular class which was for the time being the exploited class. An organization for the purpose of preventing any interference from without with the existing conditions of production, and therefore especially for the purpose of forcibly keeping the exploited classes in the condition of oppression corresponding with a given mode of production, whether that be slavery, serfdom, or wage labor. So, for Marx and Engels, this is what a state is. This is its essence. This is its function. This is what it exists to do. It exists to keep a situation which would, without it, be untenable, because no one would put up with it. A situation in which one fraction of society does all of the work that society lives on. Now, the other important part of the answer to the question, why, how could this be sustained? This seems an untenable situation. Why would the working people put up with it, is ideology, what Marx and Engels call ideology. And the most important part of this ideology, which will include many things, racist ideas, sexist ideas, but most importantly, I think, because it applies to all such ideas, is the idea that things have always been this way. Things must be this way. In the interest of time, I'm not going to... Well, okay, so I will read it. Okay, because it's a good... Okay, quotation 4. This is, again, from the Communist Manifesto. The selfish misconception that induces you to transform into eternal laws of nature and of reason, the social form springing from your present mode of production and the form of property, historical relations that rise and disappear in the progress of production, this misconception you share with every ruling class that has preceded you. What you see clearly in the case of ancient property, namely, that it couldn't last. What you can admit in the case of feudal property, namely, that it was going to go away. You are, of course, forbidden to admit in the case of your own bourgeois form of property. He's not talking about you, but he's now talking about capitalists. But I think it's not just about the ruling class. If you could go back 500 years to feudal Europe and talk to a person on the street and say, you know what? It's possible to live without kings and queens. Like, that might have been, no doubt, surely, a very difficult thing to imagine. How could you possibly? I mean, for us, obviously it's possible. But I think people have the same, and this is their point, this is what it's always like. And that's what it's like for us. That is, it's very difficult for us to imagine any way that human life could be organized on Earth other than the one in which we now find ourselves. It seems, if somebody says, no, we're going to get rid of capitalism. In fact, we have to, otherwise. Yeah. I think the most common response is to think, then we're dead. Because it's impossible. How could we possibly, couldn't work. So the Communist Manifesto is a screed written against capitalism in a certain way. It's arguing that we need to overthrow capitalism, but a surprising amount of it is about what is so unique and historically speaking positive about capitalism. And two features of capitalism are especially noteworthy. One, it is responsible for an historically unprecedented expansion of our ability to produce the things we need. And two, it has united the world in a web of thoroughgoing interdependence in a way that has never had any precedent in human history. If you turn again to the quotations, quotation 5, speaks to the first point. Marx and Engels write, the bourgeoisie, during its rule of scarce 100 years, has created more massive and more colossal productive forces than have all preceding generations together. Subjection of nature's forces to man, machinery, application of chemistry to industry and agriculture, steam navigation, railways, electric telegraphs, clearing of whole continents for cultivation, canalization of rivers, whole populations conjured out of the ground. What what earlier century had even a presentiment that such productive forces slumbered in the lap of social labor? So that's special about capitalism. Capitalism is not just one more kind of exploitative mode of production. There's something about the specific character of this mode of production, our mode of production, which makes us constantly find more and more productive ways of doing things. In quotation six, it offers an explanation of why the bourgeoisie cannot exist without constantly revolutionizing the instruments of production and thereby the relations of production, and with them the whole relations of society. Conservation of the old modes of production in unaltered form was, on the contrary, the first condition of the existence of all other industrial classes. Not now. Constant revolutionizing of production, uninterrupted disturbance of all social conditions, everlasting uncertainty and agitation distinguish the bourgeois epoch from all earlier ones.
I've got to really speed ahead.
So that's one thing that's special. Another thing that's special about capitalism that I mentioned and that they stress is that, you know, if you rewind history 500 years, what a person standing on this land would consume in a day would be totally unrelated to what somebody on the other side of the world would consume. But, you know, I had yogurt and granola for breakfast, and the things that I ate for breakfast were made on all of the continents of the earth. So my life, and that is sustained by the whole of humanity, and the same is true, roughly speaking, for most other people on earth. These two things are not unrelated to each other, but distinguish this mode of production from all previous ones. Now, what is the argument, though, that we have to get rid of it? Well, apart from the things I mentioned at the beginning, the fact that capitalism will kill us, there's something that I think is not as dramatic as climate catastrophe, but which is not less important, and that is that capitalism requires us to work all day. Most people work all day. And for most people, work is nothing. It's a black hole in which nothing important in your life happens. That's true for most people on Earth. And it's one thing if you live in a society where working all day is necessary to keep everybody going. But it's a whole different thing if it's unnecessary. If it's just so that a few people can put boats in their yachts. And this is the real harm, I think, even if per impossible, imperialist wars could end, racism could end, climate catastrophe were solved, there would still be the fact that under capitalism, everybody spends the best hours of their day, most days of the week, for the best years of their lives, doing something that does not develop their capacities, that does not enrich them. We live one time, and it's basically wasted. For everyone, into perpetuity. So when Marx and Engels talk in the Communist Manifesto about advanced communism, here's what they say. They say in the old bourgeois society, with its classes and class antagonisms, we shall have an association in which the free development of each is the condition for the free development of all. What are they talking about? Well, one thing they're saying is, what we aspire to ultimately is is a kind of society that has no exploitation, for one thing. But the defining feature of it is that what people do is done with a view to everyone's being able to develop their capacities as thinking people. And that society is organized around the possibility of making this available to everyone. That is not how capitalism organizes things, in spite of the massive productive forces that are made available. We work as much now as we did, as much or more now as 150 years ago. And that will never change, even though we become able to put a flag on Mars. Or, just kidding. Sorry. I heard that Trump promised to do that yesterday. Okay, I know I'm out of time. Okay, I'll just make two more points about this. Brief points, I promise. One is about why Marx and Engels are focused on the working class. Well, they both are about that, really. I mean, many political projects that we're familiar with, that we meet with all the time, urge that we focus or center or somehow prioritize above all the most oppressed. And so when, in this context, when Marxists are heard to be talking about the working class, it can seem very strange. Because taken as a whole, people who work for a wage are not the most oppressed people as a class. So why aren't you focusing on where the most urgent need is? Is an important question. And I think it's important to answer it. I mean, insofar as I am oppressed or downtrodden, something is happening to me, right? I'm on the receiving end of something. I'm passive with respect to my oppression. I'm suffering. And it is, you know, it's an understandable and familiar idea that we should focus our attention on those who suffer most. Marxists center or focus on the working class, not out of some erroneous view that the working class is the most downtrodden or oppressed or suffering, but because the working class is the only social force that is strong enough to overcome the power of the ruling class, and which also has an interest in doing so. So what explains the focus on the working class is not its suffering, but its power. Its ability not to have something done to it, but it's a power to do something. Now, what does it have the power to do, and why is it powerful? Well, because working people make the world go round, and they can make it stop just by putting their hands in their pockets. Obviously, it's more complicated than that in practice. But and by taking their hands out of their pockets and putting them back to work, working people have the power to build society on a new basis. That is the idea. That working people can do it. The powers that we are up against are immense. And to take their full measure means looking for some force within society that could meet it. And the reason that we focus on the working class is because that's the only force that is up for the challenge that we face. Now finally, this can cause despair because working class people are full of the same bad ideas that everyone else is full of. So you look around, so when you hear, oh yeah, working class, the working class, that's the only force that can stop, that can overthrow capitalism and save humanity from climate catastrophe. The most common response is, well then we're fucked. Because when I look around, I see a bunch of racist, backward, misogynistic people who couldn't get it together to overthrow capitalism and who I wouldn't trust to refound society again. And I want to say there's a grain of truth in that. And that is, we now cannot be trusted to found society, in the condition we're in, to found a new society. That's true, but that's part of the reason why it's important to focus on the self-emancipation of the working class. It's part of the reason why nobody can just give us a new, better world. Part of the reason why we have to do it ourselves, because in the process of working together with other working class people who are black, queer, women, from other countries, from other religions, we're gonna have to work it out. Or it's not gonna work. So this process that we go through is not just, it's not just because the working class, it's not out of some false belief that the working class is already fit to run society, but the thought that through revolution it could become fit. And so I'll conclude with this quotation from the German ideology. Marx and Engels write, both for the production on a mass scale of this communist consciousness and for the success of the cause itself, the alteration of human beings on a mass scale is necessary, an alteration which can only take place in a practical movement, a revolution. This revolution is necessary, therefore, not only because the ruling class cannot be overthrown in any other way, but also because the class overthrowing it can only in a revolution succeed in ridding itself of all the muck of ages and become fitted to found society anew.